Turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 2. Ecclesiastes, Solomon's research project. Solomon asking himself, asking the world, what does it all mean? What's it all good for? What does it all matter in the end? And the research project he's telling us about in Ecclesiastes is one that he told us last week he's uniquely qualified to carry out, because he had more money than anyone, had more power than anyone, arguably the most powerful king Israel ever had. Israel had more real estate, had more influence than at any time in Israel's history, including today. Israel had a time of unprecedented, in fact, unparalleled peace, all of which put Solomon in a unique position to do this investigation, to do this research. Last week, he also told us, as we were wrapping up chapter 1, it's going to be necessary to get practical with this research, to get out into the field, to get his hands dirty. He didn't say that exactly, but by the end of chapter 1, he told us that he'd exhausted every possible thought experiment. He didn't see any purpose to creation. He didn't see any change in creation. He didn't see any place that wisdom, thought, knowledge could answer the big questions that he was asking. Couldn't envision it. He couldn't reason his way to a purpose or a meaning of life. And so chapter 2, he goes from thinking in his mind the way he was last week to testing things out in the real world. Is there purpose? Is there fulfillment? Is there real joy anywhere out there in any of life's pursuits? And in going outside of his mind, Solomon starts in the logical place. He says, maybe the purpose of the whole thing, maybe the meaning of this whole existence can be found in the fun we have. Not a bad place to start. So verse 1, we read, I said in my heart, Solomon says, come now, I'll test you with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure. He's testing himself in a sense. Can he find satisfaction in whooping it up and having a big old time? And we don't have to guess how the story turns out. Solomon is going to do what he always does. Solomon starts off every chapter telling us what he's going to tell us. I said in my heart, come now, I'll test you with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure. Go have fun. See how much fun you can have. See what happens on the other side. But surely, this is how he is going to tell us how the experiment ends. This is also vanity. He's looking backward. He says this also was vanity. Emptiness, he means. He doesn't mean this was conceited. He's not talking about being vain in the Carly Simon sense of the word. Vanity here means empty, futile, vapor, chasing the wind, grabbing smoke out of the air. To which the natural man, the worldly man, the carnal man, says, how can that be true? I mean, there's a reason they call work, work. And there's a reason they call fun, fun. And that's true. But can having fun, indulging our senses, focusing on the pleasures of this world, can that truly give us joy? Is that the road to lasting peace? Solomon investigates. He threw parties. He went to comedy clubs. He did everything the world says should be fun. And at the end of a period of time that we infer was weeks at least, perhaps months or years, he said of laughter, verse 2, madness, insanity. And of mirth, he said, what does it accomplish? Silliness, what is it good for? Because when all the laughter has faded, when all the guests have gone home, when there's nothing left but picking up the red Solo cups, what's left? When all the guests have gone home, what's left? Solomon isn't saying that fun and laughter are bad, which is good, because if he did, he'd be wrong. Scripture says, 1 Timothy 6, verse 17, God wants us to enjoy life. He gives us good things in this life for our enjoyment. We'll talk more about that before we're done. God wants us to enjoy life. But when everyone is gone home and the house is quiet, at the end of a night of storytelling and jokes and good food, and what's left? Well, nothing bad happened. No one got crazy. Nothing got broken. Even if that's true, there's still, Solomon is saying, nothing left over. The fun came and the fun went. It existed for a moment, and then, like vapor, it was gone. And I remember for years trying to convince myself that wasn't true. I knew it was true, but I kept telling myself, well, that's because I've got the wrong friends, or I'm going to the wrong parties, or I'm getting to the parties too late, or I'm leaving them too early, or the parties that I'm going to are crowded, or there aren't enough people, or the wrong kind of people, or the wrong kind of music, or I can't hear the music. Probably they were all fine. I mean, the ones where my football player friends were headbutting holes in the walls and eating light bulbs, maybe those weren't so good, but that really happened. But see, the thing that they all have in common, all parties, they all end. And when they end, there's nothing left over. I said of mirth, what does it accomplish? Yeah, laughter's the best medicine, sure. You Google quotes about laughter. Laughter's the best medicine. A good laugh is like sunshine in the house. As soap is to the body, so is laughter to the soul. And all of that is true. But none of it brings meaning to life. I was astonished. I looked up this afternoon. Robin Williams has been gone for 4 years. Yeah, I started to write. It was about a year ago that Robin Williams died, and I said I should check. It might be 2 years. 4 years! 4 years last August. And if you read any of the articles that followed his death, it brought attention to something that probably most of us already knew, but try hard to not think about. Comedy and tragedy aren't enemies. They aren't opposites. They're partners. A lot of times they fly in tandem. Billy Graham used to tell a story about a man who went to a doctor. He was dealing with severe depression. And the doctor said, well, try taking long walks in the sun. Sun can lift depression. Exercise can help depression. When that didn't work, well, read uplifting stories. Get yourself a copy of Chicken Soup for the Soul and read about good things that are happening to people. When that didn't work, the doctor said, well, maybe we can try some medication. But you know what? Before we do that, I saw this fantastic act the other night. My wife and I went downtown and we went to a club and there was a show and this show featured an Italian clown and he was hysterical. I was crying all night. I was laughing so hard and I'm laughing just thinking about it 3 days later. Go see the clown. You can't be sad watching this clown. The man looked at him and he said, I'm the clown. That was Robin Williams. Robin Williams was the clown. Made all of us laugh. I think one of the great comedians of all time, certainly of our time. And he was happy as long as people were laughing. When the audience went home and he was alone with his thoughts, he kept coming back to what does it all mean? And he kept not finding an answer. And the darkness got darker and darker and darker. Until for him, it went totally black. Because like Solomon, he couldn't find an answer. Solomon says so elsewhere. Proverbs 14:13 that Solomon also wrote, even in laughter, the heart may sorrow, and the end of mirth may be grief. That's because you're not drinking enough. That would have been my line if I was talking, me 25 years ago talking to me today, that would have been my response. That was my slogan for a bunch of years. That was my slogan, that was my strategy. Who cares if the party's good or not, as long as you're wasted? And the thing is, if you get wasted enough and you pass out at the end of the night, you don't have to be alone with your thoughts. Easy to figure out that's not the path to enlightenment. But what about in moderation? alcohol, drugs, expand the mind, find new planes of enlightenment. I can't remember who it was. There was a celebrity who was quoted this morning in the news saying, no one should leave Earth without trying LSD at least once. I went down that road, Solomon says. Verse 3, I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine while guiding my heart with wisdom and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their lives. Solomon is saying, hey, I tried it both ways. I tried being a foolish falling down drunk, and I tried drinking with wisdom. I tried drinking in moderation. And we know from elsewhere in Scripture, it wasn't just wine. Solomon was a well-rounded Epicurean. He chased all the pleasures of the senses, not just drinking, eating. 1 Kings 4 tells us that Solomon's provision for one day was 30 cores of fine flour, 60 cores of meal, 10 fatted oxen, 20 oxen from the pastures, 100 sheep, deer, gazelles, roebucks, fatted fowl. And he found out what so many others have found out. It's fun for a while to check out the new restaurant. Hey, there's a new chef. Hey, that chef has got a restaurant where he can finally, you know, be creative. He's cooking in a new style. It's pan Mexican. And and you know, I've got friends, maybe you do, who are wine snobs, and they, you know, chase the best varieties and the best vintages. I've got friends who are Scotch drinkers and can't wait to tell you how much better a 20-year-old Scotch is than a 12-year-old Scotch, and how much better this is because it's aged in this kind of barrel than that kind of barrel, and this better kind of cigar is better than that kind of cigar. And they have fun chasing that stuff for a while until they don't, because eventually it's boring. Eventually there's only so many different kinds of wine. There's only so many different varieties of Scotch, sometimes a cigar. It's not going to change your life. The latest vintage, the latest bottle, the latest tobacco leaf, it's not going to change your life. Solomon figures that out, so he shifts gears, verse 4. He shifts gears and he says, I made my works great. I got me a hobby. Like a lot of us, the hobby that he gravitated towards was puttering around the yard. Except if you're the king of Israel, it's on a slightly different scale probably than you and me. He tells us he built houses and planted himself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. Samuel Johnson says, yeah, all kinds of stuff that makes it hard for men to die. Because they're making their existence so lush and beautiful. The kinds of things that make it hard for a man to die. And you can still visit some of Solomon's projects. The ruins of his stables are a tourist attraction. Ironically, because the kings of Israel were not supposed to multiply horses. A monument to Solomon's disobedience, perhaps. You can also visit the remnants of the pools that he describes here. The water in them is mostly long gone. It interests me that the house that Scripture describes that Solomon built for himself, the house that he took 14 years to complete, even though the temple only took 7 years, that the house is long gone. All of the effort, all of the labor, all of the time that he put into it. I wonder sometimes why it took 14 years. Was it that elaborate? There's a house in California called the Mystery House, owned by an eccentric woman who's since passed. It's also now a tourist attraction. But she was always bringing in contractors to add another room and add stairs, and stairs that don't go anywhere, and stairs that go up and come down without taking you anywhere, and walls with secret panels and hidden doors and trap doors. Was Solomon like that? He always had something else he wanted to do? Or is it possible he didn't want to finish? Henry Ward Beecher says that success is full of promise until we get it. Maybe Solomon put off getting it. Maybe he delayed finishing his house so that he wouldn't have to face the fact that even his dream house wouldn't satisfy him. Maybe he stalled just because he didn't want to confront the fact that that his perfect house wouldn't satisfy his heart. But it's easy to understand the appeal of projects like that. They're tangible. When you're done, you have something. I like cutting wood, splitting firewood. I like going out and chopping a cord of wood. Because when you're done, you can see what you've done for the past however many hours. Pastor Chuck, founder of the Calvary movement, he had a thing for fountains. You go out and visit the Bible College campus, there are these little fountains everywhere. And part of it is because it's built on natural hot springs, so it lends itself to having fountains. But they're everywhere. And I remember talking to the person who was the groundskeeper when Pastor Chuck was alive, and he said, yeah, we used to hold our breath when Pastor Chuck would come visit, just waiting for him to tell us where he wanted the next fountain. Because it's tangible. Hey, I built this. At the beginning of the day, it wasn't here, but with rocks and with pipe and with a motor, with a pump. Now there's a fountain there. But no matter what your thing is, firewood or fountains or anything else, sooner or later you come to the question, what's next? What's the next thing to build? What's the next tangible thing I'm going to point to and be proud of? Solomon went through a lot of what's nexts. He built things. He bought things. Verse 7, I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house. That was a mark of real, real wealth. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the special treasures of kings and of the provinces. You know, some he'd go and fetch. Some he'd acquire through war, through conquest. Some would come to him. The Queen of Sheba and other dignitaries would come visit and lavish gifts upon Solomon. Some of the things that Solomon treasured probably weren't valuable intrinsically. There were some that were probably valuable just for how hard they were to get. We don't know from the Bible, but extra biblical history tells us that Solomon used to send people up to Mount Hermon, up to the top of Mount Hermon in the summer to bring back snow so he could have cold drinks. It's hard to get a cold drink even now in the Middle East, but this was an indulgence that Solomon was able to command. Still verse 8, I acquired male and female singers, the delights of the sons of men, and musical instruments of all kinds. Most commentators take that verse at face value, and they say Solomon hired the best bands and brought in the best DJs and had concerts in his home and would throw album release parties for promising artists. And that's probably exactly what it means. It's also possible this isn't the best translation. Instead of talking about music, some commentators suggest that in verse 8, he's talking about sex. The guy had 700 wives and 300 concubines. So whether that's what this verse is talking about or not, he certainly investigated that realm thoroughly. Skip down to verse 10. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. So it's implied, if not stated. But after all of this, what did Solomon have? Verse 9, I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Did more, bought more, had more. Also, my wisdom remained with me. He stayed sober-minded, except when he didn't. But when he didn't, it was on purpose. He said, I was strategic about this. I was analytical. I wasn't goofy about it. Because I was asking, I was searching, what was the meaning? Where was the satisfaction? Whatever my eyes desired, I didn't keep from them. I didn't withhold from my heart any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all of my labor. It was fun to work on those things. And this was my reward for all my labor. What was? The things he built, the things he bought, the things he owned. But that was it. His reward was those things. And those things were exactly what they were, no more, no less. Things. Or in some cases, experiences, the snow from Mount Hermon, exotic sexual partners, mind-bending herbs. But what do they all mean? Pile them all together, what did they represent? Distraction. Verse 11, I looked on all the works that my hands had done and on the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed all was vanity and grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun. It was what it was. There was nothing lasting. There was nothing meaningful. There was nothing eternal. In the big scheme of things, he had gained zero. Then I turned myself to consider wisdom and madness and folly, verse 12. He asked himself, what do I know now that I didn't know before? And what he knew is that nothing could excite him anymore. He was bored with all of it. You might have heard the story about the man who dies and enters the afterlife to find it's an awful lot like this life, except he figured out after a while that he could have anything he wanted just by thinking hard about it. If he thought hard, I want a new house, a bigger house, he'd open his eyes and the house would be there. I've always wanted to drive a red sports car. Oh, if I could have a red, and he'd open his eyes and it would be sitting in the driveway. He could even find that he could have a different wife. And for a while it was fantastic. And he kept conjuring up more and bigger and brighter and shinier things. After a while it started to get boring, because he couldn't think of anything newer or shinier or different. It was just variations on a theme. And he got to the point where the harder he tried to conjure up something that was better, the more frustrated that he got, until he finally just cried out, I can't take this anymore. I don't want to be here. Send me to hell. And a voice came from nowhere. Where do you think you are? Hell is having everything you want. Solomon got to fast forward and experience that for himself. We tell ourselves, because we don't have his resources, so we try to tell ourselves, you know what, it's going to be the next raise. It's going to be the next relationship that's going to make a difference. It's stages of life. Everything will be different once I learn to drive, once I graduate from high school, once I get married, once I have kids, once I have a good job, once I have the next job, once I have grandkids, once I retire. And you know, a lot of those milestones, a lot of those passages are really great. But at the end of it, what's left? A lot of times at the end of it, we end up like Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great at age 33, laid on the beach pounding his fists and crying because there were no more worlds to conquer. Some of you are thinking right now, okay, but I'm leaving a better life for my children. Doesn't that just kick the problem down the road? Solomon asks, verse 12 still, for what can the man do who succeeds the king? The king who comes after the king, in other words. Only what he's already done. The next king can't do anything that the last king didn't do, he's saying. And Solomon is saying, look, David left me money and wealth and status, and I can leave my heirs money, homes, education, but that just means that now they're going to be the ones searching for purpose and meaning. And it's interesting, usually with less success. When I was in the business world, I did a lot of work with a family business and came to find out things about family businesses. They rarely endure to the third generation. And if they endure to the third generation, they almost never endure to the fourth. Sometimes, but it's a rarity. Because the first generation does the work. The second generation inherits the wealth, and if they don't spend it, the third generation, growing up in expectation of their inheritance, learns no work ethic, develops no character, and tends to squander it. There are exceptions, but not many. And Solomon is pointing at that. Not like Solomon didn't learn anything along the way. Verse 13, I saw that wisdom excels folly, as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head. The wise man's eyes are wide open, in other words. But a fool walks in darkness. Solomon figured a few things out. It's better to be wise than foolish. If you're wise, you see where you're going. You can anticipate some pitfalls. You might avoid some of the traps, some of the hazards. If you're wise, you might miss some of the mistakes. But then Solomon goes on to ask, but even so, even then, at the end of the life, what's different? 10 out of 10 people still die. I perceived that the same event happens to them all, the wise and the fool. In the last 100 years, life expectancy worldwide has almost doubled. It's gone from 46 and change to now mid-80s. But Solomon, if he were here, would ask, what have we done but postpone the inevitable? What have we done but extended futility? 15. I said in my heart, as it happens to the fool, it also happens to me. And why was I then more wise? Why did I work so hard at being so smart? What did it get me? I asked for wisdom. God gave me wisdom. But I'm going to end up in the same grave as the foolish person. One person said, studying philosophy is going to school to prepare for death. What is living a wise life, a rich life, a full life? At the end, does it really matter? I said in my heart, this is also vanity, for there's no more remembrance of the wise than of the fool forever, since all that now is will be forgotten in the days to come. And how does a wise man die? As the fool, there's no difference. After the funeral, we'll all be forgotten, Solomon says. He didn't know that he'd be the exception, but he is the exception. Therefore, I hated life, because the work that was done under the sun, that not under the hot sun, we understand. He uses that as an expression. He means the work done out in the world, the work done in this natural realm, in this plane of existence. It was all distressing to me, for all is vanity and grasping for the wind. Vontae Davis, 10-year NFL veteran, signed this season to play for the Buffalo Bills. 1-year contract, $5 million. I don't know if you saw on the news, Sunday afternoon, he walked into the locker room at halftime, along with everybody else on his team. He did something different. He got dressed. He put on his street clothes. He went home. He retired in the middle of a football game. And you can say what you want about whether he should have or shouldn't have. But he said, I realized I was done. I realized I didn't belong on a football field anymore. I realized there wasn't anything there for me anymore. But Vontae, what about your kids? You're 2 games into the season. You're going to get paid for 1.5 games out of a 16-game season. You left millions of dollars on the table. Verse 18, Solomon returns to the question, what about the kids? I hated all my labor in which I toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to the man who will come after me. We don't know if Rehoboam was born yet, but that's what Solomon is talking about. I'm working for what? To pass it on to somebody else. If there's no meaning in what we do, then all we're doing is living for our kids. We can't take it with us. Jewish saying, there's no pockets in a burial shroud. My dad used to say, you never see an armored car following a hearse. Well, I'm leaving a better life for my kids. We tell ourselves that. Solomon would ask, well, how do you really know? Who knows whether he'll be wise or a fool? If I leave my children millions of dollars, not likely, but if I leave my children millions of dollars and they turn out to be fools, what have I accomplished? Again, lots of research says that I'm hurting them, not helping them. Rehoboam would certainly be an example of someone who didn't benefit from his inheritance. If I live my life for my children and my children turn out to be fools, can I claim my life had meaning or purpose? If I leave my children a sizable inheritance and they use it to build a criminal empire, can I rest in peace? Is the world a better place? We were doing our will, Ann and I, this summer. We've got one daughter. We have no grandchildren at the moment. So it's pretty straightforward transaction. Okay, if I die, it goes to Ann. If we both die, it goes to Michaela. How hard can this be? Lawyers make things really hard. Well, do you want her to get all of it all at once? Or do you want to hold back some until she graduates? What about when she graduates college? Do you want to make some of it conditional on her graduating college? Maybe you don't want to give some of it to her until she's like 30 in case she just goes crazy in her 20s. I mean, at the end of the day, who are we kidding? She's going to live her life. If we're gone, she's going to make her own choices. If we're here, she's going to make her own choices. Can't control another person. Yet he'll rule all over all my labor in which I toiled, Solomon speaking of his son. He'll rule over all my labor in which I toiled, in which I've shown myself wise under the sun. This also is vanity. I'm working this hard for what? Because all the wills and trusts and contracts and provisions can't make a person wise. There's no way to know that all of his efforts wouldn't be for absolute squat. And realizing this does nothing to cheer Solomon up. Therefore, I turned my heart and despaired of all the labor in which I toiled under the sun. For there's a man whose labor is with wisdom, knowledge, and skill. He's talking about himself. Yet he must leave his heritage to a man who's not labored for it. This is vanity and a great evil. It's not fair to sow and not reap. It's not fair to reap what you haven't sown. But if he can't tell himself he's doing it for his kid, he's back to asking, what's the point? For what is man for all his labor and for all the striving of his heart with which he has toiled under the sun? For all his days are sorrowful at that point and his work burdensome. Even in the night, his heart takes no rest. This also is vanity, useless, empty. Sleeping isn't any better than waking. Yeah, the body needs rest, but nothing's different when you wake up. Wake up and the problems are all still there, so you lie awake in bed, waiting for the problems that you know are waiting. So what's your conclusion, Solomon? Help us out. After all of this, what can you tell us? What do we take away? Verse 24, he tells us, nothing is better for a man than that he should eat and drink and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. Except no. Because that's a bad translation. Problematic, at least. Literal translation, a man can do nothing to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. That makes more sense in context, doesn't it? In light of everything that he's saying, eating, drinking, projects won't bring meaning. Man can't find meaning in those things. That's what Solomon is saying. My dad always told me not to buy a new car because it loses a third of its value as soon as you drive it off the lot. 5 minutes after you drive the new car away, it's depreciated by a third. Solomon is saying 5 minutes after you die, you've depreciated 100%. But he realizes, verse 24, this also I saw was from the hand of God. This is how God designed things. Verse 25, listen. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him? It's not what it says in my Bible, Patrick. I know. I jumped to the New American Standard because New King James, again, is not translating well. For who can eat or who can have an enjoyment more than I? Okay, that's true, but that's not what Solomon is saying. What he's telling us, who can eat and who can have an enjoyment without him? That's the conclusion of his experiment. Our founding fathers told us that we're endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. No one can take away our right to chase happiness, to try to find it wherever we can. But what Solomon is pointing out, the only thing worse than chasing it and not catching it is catching it. We can chase happiness all we want. We can't find or manufacture joy. Enjoyment, verse 25. Joy comes from one place. Where does joy come from? It comes from the Lord. Happiness is about our circumstances. Happiness is about the condition of our being. It's external. It's extrinsic. Joy is internal. No one can steal it, but no one can give it to us either. It comes from God. So God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight, verse 26. But to the sinner, he gives the work of gathering and collecting that he might give to him who is good before God. No, that's not the same thing. God's not Robin Hood, giving to those who obey him and taking from those who defy him. There's some truth to that in the world. You can look around and say, isn't it interesting the number of Bible colleges and seminaries that used to be Playboy mansions? Calvary Chapel Bible College used to be a resort. And then the stories about the parties that went on there explain why there's so much demonic activity there sometimes. How do we know that Solomon wasn't confused on this? Well, two reasons. One is he had the book of Job. He knows that it's more complicated than that. Two, he says that's not the whole story. Verse 26, he tells us God gives to the good and takes away from the sinner. No, verse 26, thinking like that is also vanity and grasping for the wind. So what's not vanity? What is joy? How do we find it? Where do we find real fulfillment in this life? We go to the source. Paul tells us, 1 Timothy chapter 6, I said we were going back there. 1 Timothy 6, Paul says, command those who are rich in this present age not to be haughty, not to trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God. Trust in the living God who gives us richly all things to enjoy. Let them do good, that they be rich in good works, ready to give, willing to share, storing up for themselves a good foundation for the time to come, that they may lay hold on eternal life. Paul's saying the same thing that Solomon is, just way more concisely. He's telling us, the more we run after life, the less we find it. The more we run after life, the less we find it. The more we receive life as a gift from God, the more likely we are to enjoy it. Seek God. Hear from God. Obey God. Find joy. That's it. I knew that coming in, Patrick. Could have stayed home and watched the Royals lose to the Pirates. Are you sure? Yeah, the Royals are going to lose to the Pirates. We're sure about that. But as we wrap up tonight, are you sure you really have a handle on where joy comes from? Because lots of believers don't. I was talking to someone the other day who said, I'm just exhausted all the time. I said, are you sleeping okay? Well, it's not that exactly. It's just I go to work and I pour out there and I come home from work and, you know, some evenings is ministry and I'm pouring out in ministry and some evenings is family and I'm pouring out in family. And I get home and I just need to be awake but not pouring out. So, you know, I try to read something for fun or I flip on the TV for a while or I play a game on my phone, just something to recharge, but it doesn't really work. I read or I watch or I game until I fall asleep and I get up and I do it over again and I'm just exhausted. I asked him, where do you find your joy? He said, what do you mean? I said, what do you mean? What do I mean? What do you have in your life that gives you joy? And he said something really sad. He said, this life isn't about joy. It's about sacrifice. Joy is waiting for us in heaven. And I said, oh man. I needed to hug him. I said, you have it so horribly wrong. And I felt so bad because he was making the same mistake as Solomon. I mean, not exactly the same, but pretty close. Without even meaning to, he was living his life under the sun. To which he said, no, I know God, I worship God, I serve God. And all of that was certainly true intellectually, conceptually. But practically, He was living his life horizontally, not vertically. Here's a job, work it. Here's a family, love it. Here's a ministry, serve it. See, but in doing those things, good and godly things, he had an attitude, I'm following orders. The directions come down vertically from my commanding officer. And from there, I go out and implement things horizontally. How is that not going to be exhausting? Where did Paul tell us our meaning, our purpose, our joy? Where does he say those come from? They come from God. How? In the ministries that God gives us, in the good works that he prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. Ministries, yes, to family and to church. Ministry to him. But question, how do we do those ministries? How does God even expect us to know our ministries? It's conversations with him, right? Through word and through prayer. And we do our ministries through the power of the Holy Spirit, yes? Does any of that happen automatically? Not for me. I don't think for anyone. I think knowing what God has given us to do and finding the power that he gives us to do it, that comes from choosing to walk in the Spirit. That's how we find fulfillment. Is it sometimes hard? You bet. Do we sometimes labor and not see any fruit at all whatsoever? You bet. Can we still have joy during those seasons anyway? You bet. How? By knowing that we know that we know we're doing the things that God has placed us in the world to do, and that we're doing it His way, and that He's well pleased, whether we see it or not, whether it makes sense or not, whether we like it or not. But when we don't see or understand, when we don't like what we're doing, what do? Not asking what we should do, what do we do, most of us, most of the time? Don't we find ourselves doing an awful lot of the things that Solomon just described? I am just so fried. Let's go out with friends tonight. Let's go over to your parents' house tonight. Let's stay home and have a drink. Let's just get takeout and watch a movie. I'm going to go out and putter in the garden. I'm going to go out to my shop and build something or break something. I'm going to go online and collect something. Let's play with the kids. Let's go see the grandkids. And the point isn't that any of those things are bad. Those are good and mostly godly ways to rest, to relax, to unwind. We all need that. My doctor asked me the other day, what do you do to relax? I said, why are you asking me? No, I did ask him. I said, why do you ask? He said, I want to make sure you have an answer. You'd be surprised how many pastors can't answer the question. It's important to have an answer to the question. And he's right. Rest is biblical. But here's the thing. Resting is not the same as recharging. Resting is not the same as recharging. Joy comes from serving the Lord. Serving the Lord means serving in His strength. We don't renew our strength watching TV. We don't renew our strength gaming. We don't renew our strength hanging out with friends. Our strength comes from the Lord. Don't confuse resting and recharging. Don't confuse being tired with being depleted. Plenty of days I go home, did I give the right counsel? Did my message make sense? Is the church budget in line? Do we have ministries covered for women's retreat? Am I doing a big thing badly? And my natural response, natural as in carnal, as in fleshly, Patrick, you just need to rest. You've been to church all day. Put your feet up, watch a little Netflix. Play a little Scrabble. That's old people gaming. let your brain wind down. Get some sleep. And All of that is good and probably necessary. But none of those things are going to answer the question, Lord, am I doing your work your way? None of those things are going to bring me joy. Joy comes from knowing that I am doing God's work His way. And knowing that I am comes from the great I am. The joy of serving comes from the one we're serving. When we lose that, because we all do, we're not going to find the thing that's coming to us vertically by searching horizontally. When we lose our sense of purpose, our sense of meaning, when we lose our joy, we're not going to find it playing or puttering. We're not going to obtain it with friends or family. Joy, Solomon finally figures out, verse 24, joy comes from the hand of God. We find it spending time with God, hearing from God, obeying God in the strength God supplies. Looking for it anywhere else? That's chasing the wind. So Lord, help us know the difference between tired and depleted. Help us know when we need to rest and when we need to recharge, when we need to renew ourselves in you. And Lord, help us remind each other to keep you in the center of our lives, to prioritize the vertical, and knowing if we do, the horizontal will take care of itself. Lord, keep our eyes on you, our trust in you, our hope in you, our purpose, our meaning, our joy. Lord, remind us and help us remind each other. It all comes from you. And the things we do all of it for you.